Talking landscape photography with Kristen Fletcher and Cowan.
Well, Fletch isn't here today. He's on his way to Adelaide for the tour down under bike race, but we're joined by the aerial mastermind, Mr. Tony Hewitt. And Tony, I've got some good news for you. Christian is actually here in spirit today, so we've got some special messages from Fletch, especially for you. And Yeah, and plus, we've got a new thing here at Light Minded. It's called the Auto Fletch 3000 Random Question Generator. We're going to crack that up a bit later for you. So how you been, mate?
I can't wait to hear which one comes up first.
Mate, how's it going? Long time no catch up. Christmas was okay and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, no, all good. I actually didn't have much of a Christmas break because I had a couple of little guys to look after, but it was still break away from normal work, but I'm back into it with a relish because I'm away next week in the UK for a week.
Wow.
Back in Perth for a week and then off to the US for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And then a month's break, and then I'm in Africa, New Zealand, China, exhibition in the middle of the year.
Wow.
We've got APA happening. Mm. We've got Christmas Island. Not Christmas Island, Kangaroo Island.
Yeah.
I'm going to go over there and do a workshop with Alex Kearns.
Mm.
And we're really excited to be able to go and support that community in light of, you know, the recent bushfires, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, busy, busy.
Oh, good stuff, mate. And how's Gert by Sea going?
Gert by Sea's good. Gert by Sea Project is the website, gertbyseaproject.com. The book's been selling steadily, which is great.
Mm.
And we've even had one complete collection of the 100. So a complete exhibition collection, if you like, which was the 100 we had, purchased by one of Perth's newest and greatest apartments setting. So a big high-rise apartment, which came and looked at it and said, we want to decorate our entire hotel public spaces with your exhibition.
Oh,
so that was fantastic.
Cool. And have you been listening to the Aerial Series podcast, mate, or...?
I heard Mika, lovely lady. I love Mika. She's such a gorgeous lady. You know, and one of the things about Mika that always jumps out at me is she's just so passionate about what she does. She loves it. And, you know,
yeah,
I take my hat off to her because, and I'll say this the right way, she had the courage of her conviction. She knew what she loved and she was prepared to go for it. So she's getting some success and she deserves every bit of it because she's out there working hard. And the rewards are coming. So now I'm really watching how she progresses in her career with a lot of interest.
Do you know, it's...
I don't know if she shared with you. Did she share with you the little episode of Christian and I singing Gilligan's Island in a cabin with Mika?
No.
Maybe I shouldn't. We were down at the bottom end of one of the gorges in Karajini where there's a circular pool.
Yeah.
And she was walking around one end and Christian and I were on the other. And something, I forget what happened, but she was sitting on the little waterfall. No one else was there.
Yeah.
And Fletch and I broke into Gilligan's Island. And then she said, that's terrible, boys. And I think she decided to sing. And she has a fantastic voice.
Oh, of course she does. She would. She's good at everything.
Much better than Fletch and I.
Well, we heard about the foot race between her and Christian at Karajini's, and I thought that was weird enough, but apparently she won that one. The thing about Mika, look, I've got to say, it's almost as if she has only just embarked on her career. She's just got this, forgive the pun, but she's just got a laser focus, you know, and she's just so...
Yeah.
Oh, still excited for it. It's really encouraging. And a great, a brilliant aerial photographer.
Yeah, well, I mean, at the end of the day, she's a living example. So, you know, people starting out, people, you know, who've been in the game for a while and you know, losing their way or just wondering where do they go next. She's a great example and somebody to sort of take a bit of a role model of because she figured out what she loves to do and she's prepared to go after it and she's prepared to do whatever it takes. So it's not always easy, but if it's something you really want to do and be successful at, if you put the work in, you'll get the success.
She's amazing. Listen, I'm going to play you this this message here from Christian. So, mate, brace yourself. Here we go.
Hi, Cowan. Hi, Tone. Sorry, I can't be with you today, guys. I'm on my way to Adelaide. I'm going over for the tour down under where I'm going with a bunch of mates and we are going to ride our bikes around and pretend to be professional bike riders in our Lycra. Of course, we're going to go into all the cafes, and it's really funny, you know, I go into a cafe, and every time I go in there, the girls just start smiling at me, and they're kind of giggling amongst themselves, and you know, obviously they you know, find us mammals, you know, really attractive and really, you know, fit looking and all that sort of stuff. So they've always got big smiles for us and stuff. Yeah. I think that's exactly what it's all about. So, but anyway, I'm going to go to Adelaide. I'm going to ride. I'm going to take my camera, and I hope to do a bit of urban exploration while I'm there. But I'm not hiring a car this time. I'm just going to ride around on my push bike and just sling the camera around the neck, and hopefully I won't fall off. But I haven't yet. Touch wood. You know, I'm touching wood right now. I'll have some questions for you in a minute, Tony.
So there you go.
I was just going to say, you know, they say that bike riders and athletes get these happy chemicals in their brain that from the exercise, That's a proof of it. That Christian has created this fantasy based on his exercise. So good luck to him. If that's what he thinks is happening, good luck to him.
Mate, we alluded to it in the intro, but we've got this thing here, and it's called the Auto Fletch 3000 Random Question Generator. So when he's not here, it's like he's always here. So, mate, if you don't mind, I might just kick this in the guts. You ready to go?
Yeah, let's give it a kick.
Auto Fletch 3000, engage.
Sorry, mate. Still got a couple of glitches. Hang on. Okay. I accidentally clicked on the button for Fletcher's personal music collection. Here we go, mate. Here's a proper one.
You shoot with a drone. This is a big question, mate. Why don't you shoot with a drone?
Yes.
Why don't I shoot with a drone? Okay. Do you want the short answer first?
Yeah, go on.
The short answer is I don't have one.
Okay,
the long answer is, look, again, referring back to Mika, she did actually touch on it, and I think she actually referred to something I'd said. I've just always felt, for me personally, I like the camera in my hand, and I like to be in the air looking out at the potential image, the potential landscape, the content that's below me, and then choosing the areas I want. Mm-hmm. And I find that I feel like I've got more direct connection with what I want to say. That's not to say drones aren't fun. I've flown them, I've played with them, and it's certainly something I'll probably get for a bit more fun down the track and for other reasons. But in terms of my artwork, particularly my artwork, I just love the feel of the camera in my hands. Number two, you can put a phase under a drone, but there's a heavy cost and a high insurance cost. So I do like the quality I get from the bigger cameras that I can take up in the air. And I like the fact that somebody else can just do the flying for me, and I can focus on just seeing things, responding to things, interpreting them, and making my captures. That's kind of why.
Well, I'll tell you what, we put a couple of we put a question out on our Instagram page, and if you're not a member of our Instagram just yet, join it right now. Just do a search for Light Minded Podcast, and we've got a question here which is actually I reckon it's quite a good one. Where are we? Hang on a second. Okay, this is from Jovian Shadow Photography. Now, his question is, do you see aerial photography taking over ground-based landscapes in competitions? Example, Mika's recent success because they are so different. Are there grounds, he says, forgive the pun, to have two categories, aerial and landscape, to keep us non-droners and flyers motivated? Mate, it's a good question.
Well, let's split it up a bit. If we take the Australian Professional Photography Awards through the AIPP, about 3 or 4 years ago, I can't remember which, we actually did split aerial away from landscape as a subcategory.
Yeah.
So it was part of the landscape category, but it was judged as one body or one group.
Right.
And we had that there for a few years. And in current times, we've discussed, or the discussion is out there, that we should bring it back into the landscape category as just mixed in with the rest. Look, it's a little bit like saying we should split wedding into, I don't know, weddings that have churches and weddings that are in gardens. At the end of the day, the category is landscape, and landscape can be shot from many different perspectives. There are some practical reasons for separating them out, but I think at the end of the day, they're all landscapes. And I like the idea personally now, after having seen it mixed and then separated. Personally, I like the idea of them just being blended together, and just these are the landscapes and they're mixed up. There's a second part of the question involves, when you look at people who do compositing of aerials, we're starting to talk about illustrative work. We're starting to talk about abstractions and more of a bent towards fine art. So maybe those areas can end up in illustrative categories or more relevant categories. But I think in terms of just shooting landscape from the air, I'm quite comfortable seeing them in amongst everything else, because what's the difference between standing on a mountain and doing a long scene and a drone in some cases, you know?
Well, look, I thought about this.
It's a great question.
Yeah, look, it's a brilliant question. And actually, that's a good analogy. The, wedding photography, do we have, you know, a separate competition for the, you know, for the best male shot, the best ring shot, you know, the best getting ready shot? But I'm not too sure, because let's face it, aerial photography has got an amazing impact. It's still relatively new. So when you see it, it's kind of mind-blowing. And look, the fact is, it's expensive. Whether you get up in a plane or you buy a drone's probably, you know, what's a good one, worth $2,500. That's on top of your, if you're a mid-range shooter, your camera gear is probably worth $10,000. If you're into aerials, you know, seriously, like yourself, you're hiring a helicopter, which is, you know, I think an R-22, like the cheapest you're going to get is about $1,200 an hour for one of those. So I just think that maybe the aerial stuff is slightly elitist. Not elitist, but slightly, you know, it might be out of some people's range, if you like.
Sure. But the other thing to take into account then is, if you're going to do that, then if we look at nature categories, we should split the underwater stuff, because it costs money to have an underwater housing.
Yeah, this is true. Yep.
To do decent underwater photography. So every, you know, at the end of the day, it's the subject matter that separates most competition categories. Mm-hmm. It's a wedding, it's a portrait, it's commercial. It's landscape, it's nature, it's wildlife. So when we start breaking down the way we take those shots of that same subject matter, we're opening up to, you know, many, many, many subcategories. Now, if you're in a competition with 50,000 entrants, then I'm all for finding ways to break it down so you don't have 10,000 in one area.
Yeah.
But in a smaller competition, particularly in places like Australia, not as many of our competitions can justify splitting them up into lots and lots of different little pieces. And you'd like to think you can train your judges to the point where they can differentiate between what is a good shot and what isn't, irrespective of whether it's from the top of a mountain, from the ground, from a beach, from a plane. You know, it's either a good image, it's got good content, it's got subject matter that tells a narrative or has impact, it's good composition, it's well exposed, it's sharp when it needs to be sharp, so on and so forth. You know, those things have to count.
Should we crank up the AutoFletch 3000 random question generator and see what happens?
As long as it doesn't involve Leica, I'm all for it. Go for it.
Okay, here we go.
AutoFletch 3000, engage.
Hey, Tane, what advice would you give to someone doing their first aerial shoot?
Okay, advice for first aerial shoot. Number one, keep it simple. Don't try and be too complicated. Take one camera, one lens. I wouldn't be trying to change lenses at the best of times, particularly on your first shoot. Number two, keep your minimum shutter speed at a speed that is going to reduce the opportunity for camera shake. So I tend to tell people on their first shoot, try and stick it for 2/1000ths of a second or faster. The next thing I would suggest is set your camera up in auto. So there's different ways to do it. I think Mika was talking about auto ISO and things like that. I tend to do similar. Sometimes I'll put a minimum shutter speed so I can't inadvertently drop below a certain shutter speed. So you might put in 2,000 as your minimum. You might go auto ISO between the native ISO and what is the highest ISO you can go to without too much noise, and that depends on the camera. And then I'd keep the lens as not too long a lens. Some people love shooting with 200s and longer. The problem with that 200mm lens is it does increase the effect of ground speed. So if you're shooting somewhere between 50 and 100, that's going to keep it pretty simple for you. It allows you to be shooting at somewhere around 2 to 3,200ths of a second at f4, f5, 6, that sort of thing, with an ISO of 400 to 800. Most camera systems are comfortable in those ranges. But if you keep it simple like that, less chance of having coming back and being disappointed. Other things you can do are check out your focus. Make sure that when you focus on infinity, it is actually on infinity. Because some cameras will have problems searching. So if you have a camera that has problems searching, you might prefer to shoot manual. And I'm even on occasion would suggest to people they can take lenses off. Now, it's not something you want to do if you're going to drop down below 1,000 feet, but if you're up at 2,000 or higher and you're shooting flat ground, checking your lens, getting it locked off at infinity, and then maybe putting a bit of tape on it is a way to make sure it doesn't vary, because often with autofocus, it will search and search, and if your ground's moving, it may never really settle, and you can be quite disappointed. If you are going to use autofocus, don't just focus on, focusing on water. Try and find a sharp edge or a contrasty edge like the beach or the white water where it crashes. Focus on that and then recompose. So in order to manage that, I often work with back button focus. I rarely ever have my camera set up with a front button focus. That way you're not pressing the shutter to take a shot and refocusing on something you've recomposed. But simplicity is the basic key. And then setting your camera up to operate within safe parameters, and then go and have fun.
What sort of altitude?
Altitude's an interesting one because it's the same as focal length on lenses. Some people love to shoot with wide angles, and some people like to shoot with long lenses. I tend to go up in a plane or a helicopter, and I'll start somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 feet. I find that that gives me, it's interesting, Christian talked about drones earlier, because if you're staying down around 500 to 800 feet, and keeping in mind legally most places in WA or Australia, you're not allowed below 500 feet in a plane or chopper, you know, you're down around drone range, so you're competing or you're taking shots that other people can get with a drone.
Yeah, right.
At 2,000 and higher, you technically should be getting shots that they can't get. That's the first thing. It also, the higher you go, the advantages are that the effective ground speed or relative ground speed is minimized, so you get less chance of blur and movement. However, the higher you go, the more atmosphere between you and the ground. And even though we don't actually see it per se, there's atmosphere between our lens and the ground. And if you think of shooting mountains in the distance, you get that hazy look. The higher you go, you can have those issues. So for me, 2,000, 1,500 are good points, starting points. If I've got something specific, I might drop down to 800. And I've on occasion, GURP, I see we went up to, I think the highest we did was 8,000 feet, where we got a massive whirlpool off Darwin that was, you know, 3.5-4 kilometres across. So, yeah.
So how did you, I mean, you saw that weather event and you just thought, well, let's go higher and see if we can get something out of it, or, you know, what to, I guess what I'm saying is, and we asked Mika this last week as well, when you're going out for a shoot, you've got, you know, I'm assuming you've got a plan in mind, like you've got an idea of what you actually want to get out of it, but how often do you get up there and your plan just goes out the window? Like something like this weather event happens where you find yourself going up to 8,000 feet, or was that planned? Did you see it happening on the ground, and, you know, did you plan for it?
The way I look at that is this, that when Matthew Flinders set out from the Northern Hemisphere in Europe to go and explore the southern areas, he had heard stories of the southern lands. He was heading down this way to do some mapping, and he kind of knew where he was going and he knew what he was looking for, but at the same time had no idea what he would find.
Right.
When we did GURP on sea, we knew what we were going to do. We were going to take off from Perth, head out over the coast and turn left. And travel around and keep Australia on the left. We kind of knew what we would be looking for, but we had no idea what we would find, because weather conditions, ocean conditions, all of these things are transient. They're forever changing. So you're never quite sure what you're going to find. When I do an aerial shoot, not dissimilar to Mika or Tanya or Christian or Peter Eastway or Paul Holland or Scott McCook or the other, you know, many great aerial photographers we have in this country, you do a little bit of pre-planning. You might look on Google Earth. You might get a feel for the type of terrain. But then once you're up there, you don't know if there's been recent rains on salt lakes. You know, unless you start looking into low tides. And I think Mika referred to low tides off Broome. And when we went around Australia, of course, the tides, because we were just continuously travelling, we knew that that part of the coast would be at low tide, but the next part would be at high tide by the time we got there. So you'd have a rough idea of what to expect, but a little bit of cloud cover softens the light. No cloud cover and you've got harsh light in the middle of the day. Full cloud cover and it's flat. Everything's always different. So I think you can go out with some level of expectation, but it's important not to tie yourself into that expectation, because you might just blinker yourself and miss out on some pretty incredible opportunities that you could never have planned for.
Look, that's a really, really good answer. Look, I've got another question here too, because a few folks were excited about you coming on the podcast, Tony. So thanks for joining us. And look, I've actually got a message here on Instagram. This is from a guy called Steve Gosling. And I believe if you do a Google search, he's like one of the best photographers in the world. But anyway, Steve said,
what can I possibly tell Steve that he doesn't already know?
Mate, he's a fantastic bloke, and hopefully we can get him to back to WA again soon. Mate, he wants to know, how do you cope with Christian Fletcher's sense of humour? Mic dropped.
Well, first of all, there's an oxymoron. Who said it was a sense of humour? I thought he was just trying to make sense.
I think Christian does. I think he said
Look, without blowing smoke where it doesn't fit a Christian, because the like was far too tight.
On any man, I think, it's far too tight. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think the key, isn't it interesting, one of those little IP BMW, electric cars just drove past exactly the same.
What,
he must be spotting on me. Look, I think it's imperative, creativity and imagination and art, creating art, go hand in hand with curiosity. Now, the greatest living examples of curiosity at work are children. And when I listen to Christian's humour, I cannot help but see the child in him.
Yep.
And I think it's that child in him that he entertains, that he fosters, that he never lets go of. Is one of the reasons he's one of the world's best landscape photographers, because he constantly has fun. He's always curious. He's exploring. And I think that's the key. You look at Mika and her enthusiasm, her passion. She's a grown woman, a mature woman, a smart lady, but she's also got an element of childishness about what she does. Peter Eastway, I forget how old Peter is. I mean, I don't know if the whole record's that old, Peter is like a little kid when he's on tour. When he's out taking pictures, he's like a little kid. And I'm sure these guys would say the same or worse about me, that I do my best work when I throw that mature, ordered, disciplined part of me, and not throw it away, but park it and just have fun and just be curious. So coming back to Christian's sense of humour, I think that's an integral part of what makes him such a great photographer. And I think some of these other photographers who have pretty interesting senses of humour, you could put it down to the same thing. I'm not sure about Steve yet. I'll have to work on him.
Steve's a pretty funny bloke too, but it's interesting. I mean, you touched on it, and Fletch is probably going to be listening to this, so mate, we're going to pump your tyres up for a bit. He is one of the best landscape photographers in the world, and he has a lot of fun. He has fun on the podcast. He has fun in his normal life. He sees the bright side of everything. He is a very serious photographer, but he doesn't appear to take things too seriously. And sometimes you speak to photographers that are just so serious, and it comes out in their work. So I think...
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's
Leonardo da Vinci, and I forget the quote exact, but it was something like Leonardo da Vinci said, "Where the spirit does not work with the hand, there is no art." In other words, the practical mechanics, the application, the physical act of making and creating has to be tied in with spirit, with heart, with passion. Mika's an example of it. Christian's a great example of it. You look at all these great photographers we admire. They're all got that love, that passion, that heart, that curiosity, that weird sense of humor, the quirkiness, something that is tied into hard work, hard-earned skill sets. They know their stuff. They know how to use their gear. They know how to edit. They know how to capture a quality file. But they tie that in with this level of curiosity and imagination and fun. You use the word fun. That's what's creating the best work. So when people are starting out, whether it's aerial or doing any type of work, you've got to keep that sense of fun. One of the things with aerial, and coming back to that since that's the topic of today, often people, if they haven't done much of it before, there's a level of intrepidation or anxiety. A lot of people don't realize I'm actually afraid of heights and I get airsick. So traveling around Australia, and this is letting something out of the closet, I took airsick tablets every day.
Wow, okay.
Now, I'm sure there were days I maybe wouldn't have got sick, but I wasn't prepared to take the risk.
Yeah.
So, you know, that level of anxiety takes away the chance to have fun. You watch a child when they get anxious or worried, they stop playing, they stop exploring. So if you can remove that. So for me, I knew that I would get airsick, so I removed that. The fear of heights is something that my joy of aerial photography seems to counteract. So I think it's important, really important, that whatever you're doing, if you've got some fears around it, talk to somebody about it. Ring up somebody who's done it before. Allay your fears. Talk to the pilot.
Yeah.
When it comes to aerial, one of the best things you can do before you fly, and again, I think Mika talked about it, so she's kind of stolen most of the thunder, but have a chat with the pilot.
Yeah.
Create a level of communication with the pilot. Talk about the language you will use. Talk about some symbolism, some hand sign language that you might indicate. How far I want you to bank. Where is it? Use things like a horizontal clock. And by that, what I mean is, you know, the target that I'm looking at is at 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
It's 45 degrees down. The pilot then in their mind knows exactly what you're talking about, even if they can't see it from where they're sitting.
Yeah.
So get rid of those things that will stop you having fun, because the fun element is integral to you getting the best out of yourself.
Okay, well, let's take another random question. Stand by.
So, Tone, who's your favorite pilot?
you bastard. my favorite pilot is my dad. My father's a pilot, and he put me in a plane when I was 3 years old. Sat me on two cushions, gave me the steering wheel, because it had a steering wheel, not a joystick.
What, let you drive?
And
a plane,
he told me, pointed at an island, and I had to fly this plane back for him. Having said that, I'm gonna say that and I know why Christian's done this. He's a bugger. But Roger Avery out of Busselton, who was our chief pilot for the GURP IC. He's been the chief pilot for a lot of the ND5 projects. He's the pilot that I've traveled the most with. I feel perfectly safe with him. But I have to say that very close to him as favourites, and I'm equally as comfortable with, Steve Kruger, who was our second pilot on that ND5 trip, the GURP IC, and Peter Hales, who taught Roger to fly. In fact, Peter taught Christian and his brother Michael how to fly, I believe, Peter Hales. So those three guys together. But, you know, Roger owns the plane, and Roger's the one I've always gone to if I recommend a pilot. It's a good question, because it gives me an opportunity to share the fact that you must be comfortable with your pilot. As I said, communication. But the other thing I tell every pilot I fly with, even if it's the first time or I've been with them 10 times, I'm going to ask for the world. When I'm up there, my brain, I'm having fun. I'm locked into exploring ideas, exploring shapes and forms, watching the light, watching how it moves with the water. And I'm going to be chasing an idea. And when I see that, I'm going to ask for things. Can you give me more bank? Can you take me over here? I want you to do everything you can without putting me at danger. And if you say that's all you're getting, I'm not going to argue with you, but I'm going to ask first anyway. And I remember being with Peter Hales over southwest of WA on one of the ND5 things, and we were photographing a pink lake, and I said to him, can you give me a bit more bank, left wing down, left wing down? And he kept doing it. And then there was this sudden beeping noise. It just went a long drone, you know, beep. And I looked at him and he said, don't stress, the plane's falling. That's the stall warning. He said, we're no longer flying, we're just falling, so hurry up and get your picture so we can take off again. And it kind of made me think, okay, it's in his hands. I'm in his hands. And literally, you're putting your life in their hands. So ask for the world, but trust them and give them permission to just keep you safe, and they will anyway.
All right, well, let's take
Roger Avery and the other two guys.
Let's take another random one. Here we go.
Do you have any tips for people wanting to explain to a pilot exactly what they need to be doing to get the shots that, you know, you need to get when you're doing aerials?
Oh, that's very timely. Very random question, that one.
Yeah. So, as I said, you know, talking about using clocks to indicate direction of targets, you know, 12 o'clock's in front, 6 o'clock's behind, 9 o'clock's on your left and 3 o'clock's on your right, 45 degrees down, you know, 70 degrees down, whatever tells them how far down below the plane it is. I often talk about to pilots, if I'm not shooting with a polarizer, which I often don't shoot with a polarizer, and I'm over water, depending on the angle of the sun, I'll point out that there's a certain part of the curve that I'm going to get too much reflection off the water, and that'll be the time when I might check my sharpness, etc. But as I go around, I'll point out that these parts of the curve, I don't really want to be shooting, so you can flatten out a little bit and give me more distance. I think it's just keeping the language simple and often using my hand. So if I'm shooting with the camera in my right hand, which I would obviously do, I often rest my shooting hand on my left arm because I'm shooting at the left side of most aircraft.
Yep.
And I use my left hand to indicate to fly straight, to bank, and you can't see it on the radio, obviously, but I'm using my hand, sort of tilting my hand the way I want the plane to tilt so that as much as I'm physically talking, he can hear me, but he can also see that.
What about
particularly when pilots are talking to other pilots or, putting in calls to air traffic control, I can still control the pilot without having to talk to him just by using my hand.
What about the briefing on the ground?
Yeah, so you take into account things like, okay, if I'm shooting the coast, I'm shooting in the morning. If I'm doing the west coast and I'm shooting in the morning, then when I'm on the ocean side looking back at the coast, the light will be reflecting back off the water. When I'm on the coast side looking out to the water, I've got the sun behind me, so there's less reflection. So I might point out that the shots I'm taking on that, if we're traveling north along the coast, the ocean is on my left as we fly up the coast. They're the times I can get the shots without any reflections. As we come around on the curve, I can get shots down the beach. The minute we get to the water, I might do some zigzagging so that I'm never parallel to the beach, so I don't get that reflection that I'm looking at. I can shoot at angles and things like that. So I'll talk to about that. I'll talk to them about where we're going. Pilots, most of the time, they'll need to put in a flight plan, so they'll want to know where you intend to go. And then I'll also ask permission of where we're going. Are there any restricted airspaces? Are there any height restrictions? Are there places that if I want to stay longer, we've got to get permission and so on and so forth?
What is the best time of day to do aerials?
Okay, it depends on your subject matter. If you're shooting aerials that have no water in them, then in order to get relief, you're going to rely on a little bit of shadow. So light that's directly over the top of the plane, not only, or the helicopter or the drone, not only will you have the shadow of the plane and that, you get minimal shadow distance. So you're not getting as much relief. At 45 degrees, say, you know, if we're talking 6 to 6, so sunrise 6, sunset 6, let's say 9 o'clock and the sun's sort of in that middle of the sky, sort of 45 degree, you get a reasonable shadow. Early light, like just before sunset or just after sunrise, you get a very low light with very long shadows. And it's those shadows that give us relief and give us texture. They give us structure on the ground. When we involve water, there's other things to include. So when you're shooting over crystal clear, you know, green tropical waters, cold waters and things like that, the colour often is what you're chasing. Same with salt lakes to a degree. The higher the incidence of light, often the more colour you get. But the higher the incidence of light, the less structure you get from the ground. So, for instance, if you're shooting over water that's got a ripple on it, let's say a little bit of a wave, and you want to see that texture of the wave, you need a light that's not too high. You want it at 45 or lower so you can get those shadows on every wave, which gives you the structure and the texture. But by doing that, the lower the sun gets, the less colour you get. One of the reasons Shark Bay is so popular is that such shallow water, you can get colour even at low light. But you'll notice with deeper waters, the higher the sun goes, the deeper the blue, and it almost can get to a dark colour. And then and the higher the sun is, the more reflection you're getting off. So the time of day, if you talk to someone like Eastway, he'll want to go up right on sunrise, particularly where there's no water because you're getting those shadows. Now, I'm talking about flat landscapes. If you fly in mountains, mountains often have a 30 to 45 degree pitch. So even in the middle of the day, the sun coming down on the edge of that mountain, any trees are getting a long shadow. So it's the time of day is relative to the direction of the light being provided by the sky or the sun, which is directly related to the landscape or the platform that you're shooting. Is it flat? Is it angled? Does it have crevices, etc.? So there's a lot of things to take into account, but you just have to anticipate the structure of the ground or the shape of the ground, if you like, the topography, and the effect or the consequence of the angle of the light on it, and including structure, as in shadows, or colour, as in light penetrating water and bringing up colour.
Look, I've got another question for you. I was watching that Snap Happy TV, the episode you're in a helicopter in New Zealand, in the snow, on a mountain. Mate, how do you shoot snow? A lot of people a lot of people struggle with that. They overexpose and all that sort of stuff. And, mate, how do you do it?
Okay, so I go back, you know, I shot 991 weddings. No, 991 weddings, yeah. So one of the things I learned from weddings was the biggest challenge of a wedding photographer, you said, what's the single most biggest challenge is the contrast between a black suit and a white dress. Okay. Now, if you shoot with your camera on auto exposure and you vary your composition, and let's say you're using center weighted exposure and you're using shutter priority for your exposure, as you go to press the trigger and you focus, if you're pointing at the white dress, then the camera will try to underexpose that dress by a couple of stops. If you point it at the black suit, it'll try to overexpose. And the reason that happens is the camera's trying to replicate whatever it's looking at, or the part that it's exposing correctly for, inverted commas, it's trying to replicate it as 18% gray. Now, the dress generally would be somewhere between 2 to 2.5 stops brighter than gray. The suit will be anywhere between 1 and 2.5 stops darker than gray. So if you point at the suit, it's trying to make it 2.5 stops brighter, as in make the black look gray. If you take your camera, leave it on, have your exposure compensation at zero, do a, you know, center weighted or average weighted metering, point it at a snow field, it looks at that. It doesn't know whether it's looking at snow or black molasses. It looks at whatever it's looking at and says, right, we're going to expose to make that gray. So when you look at the snow, it comes back and it's underexposed. So the trick is to know that snow, if it's predominantly all snow, it's going to be 2.5 stops brighter. So here's what you can do. A, you can set your exposure compensation meter to +2 and it will look at the snow and it will overexpose the snow, inverted commas, by 2 stops, which turns the gray back to white. Or what I would do now with, you know, if I'm shooting on my phase, for instance, I just use my histogram. And I know that the detail in the snow is critical. It's the snow is the subject. I don't want it to blow out. So I look at my histogram and I go as far to the right as I can without any clipping. And if I do not clip, then I've got detail in all my whites and my snow should be fine.
Look, we've got another one here. Stand by.
I know focus has always been a real issue on aerial shoots, and do you have a technique for getting your focus right? Do you use autofocus? I know in the past I've seen you tape your lens. Are you still doing that, or have you found using autofocus is good enough these days?
Now, I know we've already covered this one, but it's a major thing for people. They get up there and they start shooting, and they always, you know, people can spend 15 minutes trying to figure out their focus, and you know if you get back and your shots aren't sharp, well, you know, it's not a great
okay idea. So one of the things to remember when you're shooting, and most people shooting aerials are shooting fairly flat topography, you know, they're shooting water, beaches, salt lakes, things like that. So the field of focus is quite narrow. So first of all, you don't need to be shooting at f11 when you're shooting the beach. Okay, you don't need that depth of field. You can get away with f4.5, f5, f5.6. And if you've got a quality lens that's sharp all the way to the edge of the lens, you should be able to get away with f2.8, f4.
Okay.
So you can get away with shooting at, say, f4.5, something like that. Assuming you're able to get correct focus, and by that I mean some cameras out of the box with a lens on them, They aren't quite calibrated, so you can actually press it to go to you know, be in focus. And if you look at it, it needs to be trimmed. You can get that done at a camera shop. Some of the cameras allow you to do it in camera, like a Phase XF system will allow you to trim your focus. So when it says it's at infinity, it is at infinity, etc. Other lenses come out of the box pretty straight on. So using live view will help you to check your focus. You focus on something with live view, and then press autofocus, take 2 different shots and see whether they're equally as sharp. If you shoot at wide open lenses and do autofocus, it'll tell you how close to being correct it is. When I shoot, I sometimes tape. If I tape, I'm taping off what I know to be exactly sharp at infinity, and that's what I'm shooting. So I'll do a test the night before. I might do a shot, which is something Les Walkling showed us, and Peter, shooting something that might be a light post 4 kilometers away in the dark, so you just got the light and you can focus on that light wide open and then look at where my lens is and make a note of it. I actually have on my phone photographs of exactly where my lenses are when they're pin sharp at infinity wide open. That's where Christian might be referring to when I've taped them off So I'll tape them off exactly there. These days I don't do it as much because I actually just know exactly on my lens where it's sharp. Now, if I'm using autofocus, when we did Gear by C, we used Canon systems because it was sponsored by Canon, and we used a 5DSR. I used the autofocus system on that, and I've got to tell you, 99% of the time, it was bloody good.
Yeah.
If there was, as long as there was a line of contrast for me to focus on, and then I would almost turn the focus off. If we're staying at 2,000 feet and it's focused, I don't need to change it. It's not going to change. So focusing, making sure your autofocus is working and it's got something concrete to grab onto, to grip, works. But it really is important you know your system.
Look, I've got another question here on Instagram. This is from Tracy Cook Photography. She'd be interested as to whether Tony and or Sir Peter Eastway will be recording any more creative live classes, particularly around aerial photography, please.
Not at this stage. We don't have plans to. It's not to say we wouldn't do it if we were asked. Interesting question. I'm hoping she enjoyed the one she did see. But both Peter and I run various types of programs. I mean, Middlehurst has a very large aerial component where we have helicopters and sometimes we use planes as well. We fly around the mountains, we fly down the valleys, over vineyards, black sandy beaches, etc. And then we go back and look at the work, do feedback, do editing, do printing, and then you get a chance to do another flight. So, you know, they're the sort of times people can get access to direct training. But in terms of videos, not at this point, no. But tell her to contact me. I'd be interested to know what the thing she thought would work.
Autofletch 3000 engaged.
Gird by Sea was probably one of the biggest aerial photography shoots that's probably ever been undertaken in Australia, if not the world. Is there any particular area that you flew over that really just blew your mind?
Is this Fletcher's very, very careful way of finding out where these
he wants look, GPS coordinates.
Okay, so the best place in Australia to shoot aerials, if you had 4 days and you had to stay in one place, is a place that most people already know about, I think, and that's Shark Bay. That's not to say there aren't pockets of places, other places. So I'm saying Shark Bay because access to these amazing colours, textures, shapes, forms is very easy out of Shark Bay Airport. Shark Bay Aviation and various other groups offer great pilots, good planes. They know the area really well. There's some places in the Gulf of Carpentaria which are quite spectacular. You got to, you know, we have some incredible river systems where we have large tides. So the Kimberley offers some beautiful opportunities, but the Kimberley's difficult to get into in some places. So that's the issue there. I mean, some of the places in the top Kimberley, we had to fly in and out of the Mitchell Plateau and refuel using drums. So they're not as easily accessible.
But did you ever see anything?
Hence why some of the.
Sorry, Tony. Sorry? What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, so when you talk about the best places to shoot, there are the best landscapes to shoot, and there are the places that are accessible. The northwest corner of Tasmania is a place that shocked the crap out of me because it's got incredible sand estuary systems with crystal clear blues and greens. And it's just off the doorstep of Tasmania's northwest, you know. People wouldn't – I never expected that. Northwest and northeast Queensland, Cape York, incredible river systems bleaching out into the ocean. So, you know, where the tides move the biggest, which is the top end of Australia, obviously, we do tend to get those wide-open mud runoffs and textural patterns that everybody gets mesmerised by. And there's less tidal movement in the south, so there's probably less of that. But
Did you see any stuff that you just didn't expect that just, you know, blew your head off? Like you just, you know, the reason I bring that up is Christian has an amazing photo that he took with his drone of the Dunsborough rubbish tip. You might have seen the shot. It's a tailings dam, and I think he shot it from about 200 feet. And it's just mind-blowing. And he was, you know, I mean, that's the sort of guy he is. He just manages to find mind-blowing things like that. And we're going to stick that shot up on our Instagram shortly too, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. But was there anything like that that you just weren't expecting?
Yeah, look, the whirlpool off Darwin was pretty spectacular because it was this turquoise blue blending with brown waters that were coming off a different part of the, because there was two different sides of the island, the waters were coming from different directions. Mm. So you had this milky brown blending with turquoise blue. Mm. So that was spectacular. Seeing crocodiles 50 kilometres offshore on a sand cage, just sitting under in the shallow water on a little sandy beach.
Wow.
Sharks, manta rays, 20 manta rays in single file going along a cliff edge near Steep Point. That was pretty spectacular. Whales off Harvey Bay underneath the water where people couldn't see. Tiger sharks, 5-metre tiger sharks swimming between a boat and the beach. And on the beach was a camper van, an umbrella, a lady in a bikini or something lying on the beach, and a guy in a kayak.
They probably had no idea
there was a shark there. I saw a baby whale shark, which was being attacked by hundreds of sharks. That was quite heartbreaking.
Well, that's nature, isn't it?
Bushfires out of Victoria, which is quite topical now. Mm. Seeing a bushfire out of the southern Victoria, drifting across Bass Strait. And hazing up almost a half of Tasmania as we went around the bottom, flying around the bottom of Tasmania and in 60-knot winds and having to make a decision whether we'd go or not because there's no landing for 3 hours, You either got to go one way or you got to come back. The colours, tailings dams on some of the coastal mining areas, the blood reds of these tailing dams is quite spectacular. It's beautiful, even though it's, connotations can be less than favourable. Mm. Seeing people like off Cape York, a little dinghy, and as we came up in the plane, they frantically pulled up pots and things like that. And obviously they thought we were the Coast Guard because they threw everything in the boat and they started hightailing it straight out to sea. And I thought, what's the point? You're not going to outrun us if we really are the Coast Guard. So I saw a Japanese plane from World War II that had been basically flowing in towards the coast. So often we found out these fighter planes would come in and attack places off Papua New Guinea, but they didn't have the fuel to get back. So they were told once they'd finished their bombing run or whatever, to continue on to the Australian coast and ditch it. And it didn't quite make the coast. So it was left in the tidal zone. So at low tide, it would be exposed. At high tide, it was underwater. The entire plane was intact. Shipwrecks, sort of multitude shipwrecks. So, yeah, it was, if you see the book Girt by Sea, which you can actually get at girtbyseaproject.com, little plug there, but it's a book if you haven't got it or haven't seen it. There's 120 images in there from all around the country. There's the story of the trip, logistics, how long, how far, how much fuel, how high, how low, pilots, where we stayed, all sorts of things, the flight path, all of that. There's a lot of info. But if you just look through it, the visual poetry that our coastline offers is incredible. It truly is. So did something blow my mind off? It did. But, I'd have to be honest, the whole thing did, because every day was different. No matter what we expected, we were always surprised.
Do you reckon that downed Japanese fighter, I mean, do you reckon people know about that sort of stuff? Like, do you think that's ever been photographed before?
I think I'd be arrogant if I said no one's found, we discovered it. I'm sure people know it's there, but I didn't know about it. We just happened to, I think if you went and Googled, plane wrecks off the Australian coast or war relics, you'd probably find maps. But it was certainly a surprise to us. It was something we didn't expect. Look, I do one-on-one masterclasses with people out of Perth where we fly. I do one-day ones. We've done a four-day one out through Shark Bay. I did a 12-day one last year where we flew from Perth to Exmouth in a Cessna 210 with the same pilot I mentioned earlier. And even just doing that part of the coast, I've done it many times. I always find something surprises me. You'd be amazed how, a seasonal shift, a extra rains, a bit of, dry period, which drains salt lakes, it concentrates the chemicals, the algae, increases the concentration of a particular of chemical or algae, and suddenly the colour is richer than you've ever seen it before. Runoffs at low tide create shapes in the ground and symbolisms. So I think we are extremely blessed in this country to have all sorts of things that will blow your socks off. And if you've not done a lot of aerial, I sometimes get not blasé, I'm lucky I haven't got bored yet, but I can imagine people seeing some of these things for the first time. It's mind-blowing. It truly is. It's a privilege to see it.
Look, I just want to ask you this. Do you still have the, you know, the Mika Boynton-esque enthusiasm for your craft?
Do you know, when I get organized to go planning, I don't have the same level of anxiety. I used to get worried about, don't forget this, don't forget that, what if the camera doesn't work, you know, batteries. But now that I've done it, you know, I think I worked out I've got up over 430 hours in the air as a shooting, which is a lot. So now I just follow the process, you know, batteries on the inside pockets, blah, blah, blah. So in the lead up to it, the excitement level and that, you know, that sort of trepidation mixed with excitement is not as high. It's not as sort of energetic as it used to be. However, the minute I'm in the air looking down, it's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. I keep shooting and I keep asking myself, why am I still shooting this stuff? I've already got this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's because it's just mesmerizing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. It's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's obviously for people like Mika. She loves it. Mm-hmm. Whereas other people are fascinated by macro. You know, they could sit and photograph grasshoppers all day long or flowers. Mm. How many people I meet at camera clubs that just love shooting flowers? Mm. Well, I can't do flowers. I get bored too quickly. Mm. But for me, the enthusiasm once I'm shooting is exactly the same. I'm still chasing that elusive, perfect image, knowing that it doesn't exist, but excited by the prospect of maybe discovering it.
Have you taken the perfect photo?
Technically, no. I think there's always room for improvement technically. I think the closest I've got to perfection in a photo is not necessarily technically perfect photos or image, but they're pictures that move me almost to tears even to the day, you know, days or years after I've taken it. So have I taken the perfect one? No, I don't think so. It's a bit of a moot question because I don't know it exists. But I have taken pictures that I'm satisfied with that when I look at it later and I interpret it, and you've got to remember a lot of my fine artwork, my fine art aerial that I exhibit is interpretations of that original capture. Mm. If colour was what mesmerised me when I took it, I'll work the colour. If it's texture, I'll work with the texture. Mm. I don't composite. I don't blend two together. I don't mix and match. Mm. It's one shot, and then I draw from that one capture the part that... Was it the red dirt? Was it the blue water? Was it the texture of the waves? What is it that I need to bring out to accentuate, to emphasize what I responded to? Yeah, I've got a handful of pictures that I look at and think, yeah, I'm not going to touch them anymore. Mm. I'm happy. They did the job. Mm. But I still feel like there's more out there. I still feel like there's another level. There's more levels for me to go to. Mm. I truly feel like I've got more in me that's better. I'm excited to find it.
Mate, what are those levels? Like, where to now for Tony Hewitt?
I often preach that purpose is such an important driver. We start off and, you know, people are excited just by the prospect of doing something different. They're excited by the spirit of exploration. I referred to Flinders and that, and that's what drove the Gerp I See project. It's what drives a lot of my other personal projects. For me, next, it's about purpose and meaning. Why am I doing these shots? What am I trying to say? I've done a soft release of a limited edition book called Transients, where there's 10 copies of hand printed, you know, archival cotton rag stitched into a beautiful book. And this is 10 years of my aerial work. We've sold three of the 10 already. They're not cheap. But I look at that, and for me, I'm trying to produce a body of work that's a statement about what aerial means to me. Aerial to me is about understanding the value of shifting perspectives. Mm. So I'm trying to find other meanings behind my photography. It's not just pictures for pictures' sake. It's not just to decorate decor in offices. It's not just to do an exhibit. It's just to win an award. Mm. It's about helping people find things that will help them move forward. Mm. People forget that if they just shift perspective in life, They suddenly can see things in a different way and often move past challenges or find answers to questions that they've been struggling with. Mm. And aerial photography is a great metaphor for that. Mm. I can show pictures, people pictures of a beach that they've been going to all their life. Mm. And I show them an aerial shot and they look at it and go, my God, that's beautiful. Where is it? And I say, you stand there every second day of your life. Mm. But you've never looked at it from that angle. And then you can see pennies drop where that, where you say, what if you looked at family life like in a different way, or your business in a different way, or other parts of your life from an entirely different perspective? Just look at what's in front of you, but see it differently. Because when I shoot Scarborough Beach from above, I've stood on Scarborough Beach, but it looks totally different and I understand it differently. It has different meanings for me. So perhaps in life we can find different meanings for lots of things by shifting perspectives. So what's next for me? That's what I'm chasing, is finding deeper meanings and deeper purpose around my pictures that will help people become better at whatever it is they want to become better at. To, you know, I remember a friend, I don't know what's happened to him, Nick Jordovic, years ago, probably 25 years ago, he was doing lightning shots in Perth. Mm. This is before digital. Mm. And I might be wrong, and I apologize if I've been disrespectful or got it wrong in a way that's negative, but Nick, I believe, had some arthritis or something that was restricting his ability to do things. So he took up photography as an outlet, as a way of expressing, using creativity and art, and he produced all of these beautiful lightning shots. So he found a reason to do, he found photography for a different purpose, for a different reason. I think for a lot of us, that's what it can be. It's not just to take a picture. It's not just to get likes on Facebook or Instagram, you know?
We've run out of time. We're going to get to Ken Duncan, but we just didn't have time for that. Final thoughts. final thoughts about people wanting to get into the craft. Like, you know, if you were starting out right now, would you start with a drone if you knew what you knew now about drones? If that makes sense.
Yeah. Look, I think drones are a great way to start because you're right. Going up in a helicopter, you know, two flights in a helicopter, you could have bought yourself a drone. Mm. I think when it comes to taking pictures of any kind, let alone aerial, you need to understand the basics. You need to understand the basics of exposure, composition, you know, sharpness, focus, all of these things. We need to be good at that. You need to know your tools. You need to have the skill sets that allow you to express your vision in an accurate way. Otherwise, you get frustrated. Mm. Once you've done that, then you can start moving on to, you know, using pictures for other reasons. But getting the craft right, then you can use the craft as a means of communication. So using a drone gives you the opportunity to understand composition. Mm. It gives you the opportunity to understand the effect of atmospheric conditions, time of day, light, how light affects the look of texture on waves, how light affects the color, etc. Then when you go up in a plane, that part of it you've kind of got a little bit of a head start on.
Right.
Before you go up in a plane, you also want to be able to use your camera properly. You don't want to be learning to use your camera when you're spending $1,000 an hour. Too expensive. You know, go out and take photographs of kids. Take photographs of the sunset. Go down and try to photograph birds in flight. Shoot from the top of a building or a car park. You know, go up to a lookout. Shoot down on the ground, showing compositions. Get good at those things first. A drone will allow you to do that. So starting point, keep it simple. Even use your phone. Photograph things at your feet. Practice compositions that way. Anything really. I still use my phone to keep myself fit in terms of visually fit, taking photographs of patterns and textures just to see what works and what doesn't.
It's quite interesting that, and that's another podcast itself, but Steve Gosling, who we spoke about earlier, uses his phone for composing stuff, and then he just replicates what he sees in his phone on the camera. So yeah,
A lot of photographers used to use Polaroids, you know, and I think phones, you know, my phone's full of images that I've taken and put into an ideas folder because they're just ideas that I've seen on the ground. You know, people look at mud runoffs, you know, from 2,000 feet, you get tree patterns and all that. You can do it with a phone at 3 feet above the ground on a beach.
Yeah.
You get these little rivulets and you get the same look, you know, and it's a good way to practice composition.
Right, we better wrap it up. Finally, do you have a message for Fletch in South Australia?
I hope he gets nappy rash. no, not really. I think, first of all, you guys are doing a great job with this podcast. I like the fact that it's kept pretty low key and it's a lot of fun. But I hope for the viewers, and I hope I've contributed with some solid little tips in there. But I do think it's the mix that makes it work. Christian, just keep being Christian. I don't have any tips for Christian. I just hope he stays the way he is. I think his enthusiasm and his passion for his craft is infectious. Mm. And he's a lovely role model, not only in that way, but you know, also Christian's a great role model in terms of his love of the environment.
Yeah.
He's not just somebody who talks about it. He's active in so many ways. Those who know Christian know how much time he puts into his own community.
Mm.
And it's a good example of how you can make a difference around you, change the world around you.
Mm.
You know, focus on the things you can take action on.
Mm.
I mentioned Kangaroo Island with Alex Kearns, who you should get on this show.
Mm.
We talked about the devastation of the bushfires, and I said to Alex, you know, it's frustrating because you want to make a difference, but let's make a difference in one place.
Mm.
We put together a couple of prints that we've offered out there, if I may plug.
Mm.
We've offered a landscape print. It's an aerial shot I took on the Gert by Sea trip, actually, as we came into Kangaroo Island, and she's put up a picture of a kangaroo, and we've done them as a $3.95, two prints, reasonable size, actually, and that $3.95 gets two prints, and that money goes direct to the Kangaroo Island Wildlife Network,
right,
which are volunteers who rescue, look after, nurse back to health, and re-implement into the wild the orphaned animals.
Mm.
So, make a difference.
Act
locally. Make a difference where you can.
Act locally and think globally. Mr. Tony Hewitt, thank you very, very much for your time. And, mate, we hopefully will get you back soon.
I'm sure you will. Thanks for the opportunity to share some things. Good luck to everybody and stay safe. And one last tip for aerial photographers. When you do get in there before you take off, make sure your belt's done up tight.